Hello.
Hello.
Episode 44
of the Twinsies podcast. I'm Lucas Cook.
Dan Blewett. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
We're in full Senators gear today if you're watching the video version of this, in part because I feel very self-conscious. I have shaved my head.
I've always had a shaved head.
We are two bald jerks.
Yeah. Like, what's that word coming there?
Yeah.
Two bald jerks. TBJ.
And I feel okay about it. I don't feel that bad about it, but there's just a lot of like cue ball coming at you. So
a lot of Warbird cue ball.
You know, got a hat on right now. It is what it is. We did a little some other videos prior to this for the Senators brand. So, you know, we're all decked out. Just deal with it.
Yeah.
Okay. Just deal with it.
Stop. Hold your comments, please.
So today we're going to talk about three topics. We're going to have a little book club discussion as well, new books that we have completed. Number two, we're going to talk about umpires a little bit. We're going to talk about catching, lastly. So that's what you have in store for you today.
You're ready.
Twinsies podcast.
That's right. So we begin this discussion with book club number like four or something, or five. I don't know.
Yeah.
What book have you recently finished, Dan, that you want to talk about right now?
Well, I last night just completed Attention, This Book Will Make You Money by Jim Cockerill, which he's like a web entrepreneur, and he just talks about how he's been on the web for a long time, and he just kind of implores you and gives you good reasons and things to do of like what you should do to take things you know and are good at and how to make money on the web, potentially quit your job and do all that kind of stuff. So it sounds like one of those kind of gimmicky, like, oh, you could do it. Right. But no, he's been doing this for a long time, and he's a pretty accomplished like internet marketer and produces good content as far as I can tell. Like, I enjoyed his book, and it was a pretty good like roadmap guide for someone who does say they have like a knitting business and they, you know, don't want to knit stockings for the rest of their life. Do people have stockings anymore?
I don't know.
Whatever.
I don't
know
what people knit.
But they could, you know, hats. Take that and make an online course and sell that. And then they reach a lot more people and teach them how to create stockings rather than being a slave to making them themselves. So
give a man a fish, teach him to fish.
Yeah. Kind of thing. So I'm personally doing a lot of this stuff. So it was just another good, a lot of stuff I'd already known or been doing, but also just a lot of new stuff that just like, you know, a lot of ideas. So for me, reading is just more of getting my gears turning a lot of times than actually like physical, or not physical, but just action items. Like, oh, I learned this, I'm going to go do it exactly. Really, it's more just like, okay, that, like, I feel like I have a better understanding of the big web that I need to weave, or I need the picture.
The web. The web, get it? Because there's two kinds of webs.
Interwebs, yeah. But so my second online course is launching this week. It's launching now. It's out there, so it's an exciting time. But you know, with all that stuff, it's like, has everything I've done to prepare for this and market it well, is it gonna work? Like, we'll see. It's fascinating. It's exciting. You know, I believe in what I believe in what I do. So, and that's, I think he says that over and over and over. That's the core. And no matter what you do, like, you do have to use some techniques to try to get people to buy from you. Like, even if you're the best product in the world, people procrastinate. So having some scarcity, some like exciting things to try to get them to take the plunge. But he's like, when you have a really good product and when you really can help people and you really know what you're talking about and you've created things with a genuine like authenticity, because you do. You just want to help people get to where you've gotten, or, you know, benefit from your knowledge, which is what I want to do. Then you know, it all becomes a little easier that way, and it's not just like this big scheme, because it's not. You know, like, I have a thing that can help pitching coaches and players and parents across the country, and I'm excited to help give them that. But you also have to give them a little push sometimes to say, like, this is what you really do need, and it can help you. So, good. It was a good book for me for now. I got some others though. What do you got?
Most recently, I'm trying to think. We did this before, and then we lost all of our audio and video. So
we did. Oh yeah. All right. Let me think here.
Ready to Run is a book by Kelly Starrett, who is a physiotherapist who I like him in that he does a really good job of, I appreciate people who are very intelligent and know a lot about a subject, but they can also break it down so like anybody can understand it. And can express it to you in a way that's not super duper boring. And he does a pretty good job of that. He's at times a little cringy because he's kind of a, I don't know. He's kind of like CrossFit-y, like, nah, I'm the best kind of guy,
And he wears, jeans, demonstrating a lot of stuff. To me, I'm turned off by his personality.
Oh, speaking of, he's also a bald person now, too.
Yeah.
But his book called Ready to Run, I started reading because why? I've always kind of been like, meh, on running. I don't like running, or I didn't. I just didn't view it as a worthwhile pursuit in my training protocol. But I'm also at the point where, I mean, my training life to this point has just been pretty much experimentation, like doing a lot of different things. But it's all been relatively within the realm of strength training. So, like, I've done a lot of different types of training, but it's all been strength training. So I was like, kind of like, well, what else can I do? I was kind of getting burnt out a little bit on what I was working on. So I was like, you know what I haven't done since I was like 16 years old is run. And so one day randomly, I just went on a run. So I think I ran like 3 miles. It was very slow. Not that I intended it to be fast. And I was like, okay, well, that wasn't like the worst thing in the world. I also knew nothing about running. Because one of the things I think is interesting is, if we had a cross country, we actually did have this, that, a person came in and they were like, hey, what do you know about running? Or like, how can you help me with my running gait or like whatever? And I was like, I don't know anything about that. So
running gait, is that like a scandal?
Yeah. So, I referenced them out and I was like, well, shucks, I wish I knew something about running that I could have told them. So then anytime that I'm ignorant on a subject, I like to not be ignorant on a subject. So I picked up his book and started reading it. And really what it is just 12, the way it starts out is he gives you 12 sort of standards to hit, either physically or, through mobility or hydration or whatever it is, you know, hit these 12 standards to be I don't think he ever uses this term, but be a lifelong runner where like you can go out and run as much as you want, as often as you want, and you're not going to feel like garbage the following day or over the course of a couple months or whatever. And so I liked the book overall. I thought it was very easy to read. It was very short. But he kind of outlines these 12 metrics, how you would measure them, how you would then attain them if you are missing one of these metrics, and then takes you through, okay, you know, if you're, you shouldn't really be working on anything before you've kind of hit these 12 things. So it was a very good book. I liked it. And it had echoed a lot of things I had kind of already heard. But like I said, he does a pretty good job of, his big thing is he likes to claim that he's the movement pattern guy. So he can allegedly see, you know, when there's errors in your movements, what it's stemming from. And so he does a good job in the book of explaining basically upstream and downstream, like how everything is connected. And when you get done with a 5 mile run and the next day you wake up and your lower back hurts really, really bad, like why that's the case and what you need to look at to remedy those issues. He talks a lot about like running shoes, which I think is fascinating that, you know, there's been the sort of war of escalation in terms of running shoe technology. And one of his points is, you know, running shoe technology has gotten really, really good, but injuries really haven't gone down all that much. And so the logical conclusion is, well, maybe it's not the shoes. And so he talks about, you know, the whole idea behind arch support and making a really cushioned heel encourages things like heel striking, which you do not want to do when you run. So when you maybe overstride or you're just not running properly and you reach out and you bring your knee to full extension and then you smash the ground with your heel, that puts a lot of force through your body, essentially, whereas your muscles are meant to be shock absorbers, so cushion you as you run. And so if you're running on your heel, you're not doing that. You're basically just grinding on your joints versus if you run on the ball of your foot, that's what allows your calves to work and your quads and your glutes and your hamstrings. And so what's fascinating is we talked about this last time, but, that's gone forever. So, no, we didn't. But when people run and they kind of run with, like, duck feet, so you'll see people where – I wish you could see my foot, but these are my feet. When they run, their little foot turns out like this as they go. So they run like ducks, and then you can see their knee is valgus as they – or so their knees are kind of, like, in. And so they're just, like, running on the inside of their foot, And then they're just like crushing their knees all the time, all the time. And when you start to look people, like one of the things he said was, you know, look at a group of people running from the front. You can just see all these feet like flying out to the side, and it's really gross. And he's just talking about how, you know, when your hip flexor is short and you're missing external rotation in your femur and you have tight quads, like all these things then create that mess. And then it's exponential from there, that everything just gets way worse. And so I like that. I like being able to understand the I don't know if we'd call it science, but just the reasons behind some of the movements that you see. So he does a pretty good job of that in that book.
Oddly enough, and this is it's sort of off topic, we all see different things when we look at other people, like, you know, the opposite sex. And when I see women, there's just like the way they walk can be like a turn off, or
I would agree,
turn on or whatever. And when I see a woman who has like that kind of like duck foot where their knee kind of comes in, they're just like something in my brain. I'm not trying to be judgmental or anything. It's just like, it's like not an athletic way of walking.
Yeah, I was like,
and I really appreciate women who just like have an athletic like kind of walk. I don't know.
I would say that
like it immediately comes to mind. I'm like,
That like screams unathleticism, unfortunately. I mean, when you see that, it's just like there's something, just because it is a dysfunctional mechanical position. So if you've inherited that position and you're in it all the time, then you kind of can't really be athletic out of that position. So I would agree. Then it's sometimes hard to put your finger on, which is why I like reading kind of his stuff. And there's another book I'll reference either on this podcast or on a later one that I like even more than his. When you are offered up like, hey, here's the reason why you hate that, is this is the explanation behind perhaps why you like notice right away that like weird duck foot knee in kind of walk. So, yeah.
Okay. Which that's, I'm sure my dad will watch this podcast, but my dad is a ardent supporter of not running on your heels. And he's one of the few, because out there in the running world, heel striking has been going on forever. And he's been saying the exact same thing. He's working on a running book now. And that, you know, your Achilles tendon, like it's meant to absorb that shock. And if you're hitting on your heel, you're not getting any rebound into it. You're not getting that like elastic storage, energy storage in return. But when you lay on the ball of your foot, then the Achilles comes down and it helps propel you into that next step. And it takes some time to get strong enough in like your Achilles and to have like the endurance where you don't get really, really sore running on your toes, on the balls of your feet, because your calves obviously do a lot more
work.
They
get lit up, yeah.
But it's more efficient like biomechanically.
Yeah, and you really think about it, it's gross when you really see someone heel strike and then you think about what's happening. It is kind of gross. We're like that. Basically, imagine, I mean, it's not quite this bad, but potentially maybe. If you just like locked out your leg and you just like crushed your heel into something, like that would be really gross. And you could like feel it go through your ankle, through your knee, through your hip, all the way up into your lower back. On top of the fact that, you know, when you overextend your leg, or you take too big of a stride, you extend your leg and then you heel strike, there's a really big braking effect that happens. So you like slow down for a second and then you have to get that back. Whereas if you're running on the balls of your feet, the whole idea is it's a perpetual motion of like losing balance and catching balance and losing balance and catching balance. And so people who heel strike just have really bad engines typically. And if you can teach them, like you said, over time to land on the ball of their foot, they just become so much better at running. And there's another book that I want to read next. It's called The Pose Method. Have you ever heard of that? The Pose Method, P-O-S-E. Apparently it's a method of running. But I mean, I've never read a book on like the technique of running, which I think would be interesting. So that's one of the next ones on my list, the Pose Method. Hmm. Or maybe Mr. Blewett's book, Bill Blewett.
Bill Blewett. It's going to be a little while. He takes his time. So one of the ones I read recently, I'll go back a little bit. This is probably a month and a half ago, but I read The 7 Pillars of Highly Effective People, which is like a classic, I guess. And I really liked the author was the narrator, because I don't really read so much as I audiobook, but the author was the narrator, which usually is terrible. So not to pick on women, I read a book by a very successful Silicon Valley, like high up VP, worked for Google and Facebook, read her book on like leadership and management, and she should absolutely have not narrated that book. Her voice was like this the whole time.
I'm like,
look, you've got good things to say, and I like gritted it out, but her voice was horrible. And most of these people pay people to narrate their books. I read this book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a F-U-C-K.
Right.
And the narrator was awesome. And, like, just he made the book better. He had a really, like, smooth voice, and he, like, did inflections really well. Like, it's clearly hard to be a good audiobook narrator. And I just, like, I actually thought about, like, doing it myself. I'm like, what if I can make, like, a 200, like, because you can make, like, 50 to 500 bucks an hour narrating audiobooks. I'm like, I do all these podcasts. Maybe I've been training myself to do this. And then I realized how they make, like, no errors whatsoever reading for 10 hours straight. I'm like, that sounds terrible. That sounds like walking on eggshells. I can't get through a sentence without making an error. But anyway, I just thought, like, if I, when I complete my second book and I will have an audiobook version of it, I don't think I'll narrate my own, even though, like, my voice is, like, people tell me I have, like, a decent radio voice. Like, I have a deep voice. It's kind of monotone-ish, but whatever. I don't think I'll narrate my book, even though I think I have an okay radio voice, because I just feel like a pro can do it better, you know? Yeah. And this is a very successful VP. I'm not knocking her content whatsoever. I learned a lot from her book, but it was tough to get through it because her voice just sucked. I'm sorry.
Well, and you,
like, and someone should have, if she went through a major publisher, someone should have been like, look, this isn't the right move for you to narrate this book. Let's get a better voice actor to do this, because it just was unappealing to me.
Right, and the last thing you want to do is create more barriers to someone not reading your message.
And I've returned, because Audible was great, where you just return audiobooks. And if the narrator was bad, I'm like, I'm not going to do 6 more hours of this. Like, I'm sorry. But anyway, in this book, The 7 Pillars of Highly Effective People, or 7 Habits or whatever, he was just like this pleasant old grandpa. just going through it. And I was just like, there was just a calming presence from his voice.
Is that Carnegie? What's that guy's name?
Carnegie? Is it Carnegie?
It's Carnegie or Carnegie?
I think it's Carnegie or whatever. But I liked, I just felt, oh, it's like grandpa's giving me,
you're reading me
wisdom.
A bedtime story.
Yeah. But I thought it was a good book. I don't remember any of the habits.
I learned
something. What do you learn from books? I don't know. You take home just like a couple ideas and ways of thinking, and I felt like it was a valuable read, but I can't tell you about it. I don't know. Man made some good points.
Yeah,
I know that.
Pleasant grandpa.
But they've also all just sort of been mixing together. I don't know.
Yeah, when you read books of similar subject matters, they all kind of blend together a little bit.
Yeah, just like I read The Sports Gene and Outliers. And
The
Talent Code and A Champion's Mind within like 3 months of each other.
And I
have no
idea.
Book. They're all the same book. Yeah. I have no idea where one starts or one ends and the other one starts. But I listened to a different one last week by Dave Horowitz, who's the Horowitz and Andreessen Horowitz, which is one of the biggest venture capital firms in, again, Silicon Valley, I guess. And he just talked about his rise through internet entrepreneur and CEO. He's been a CEO of a couple of different companies, and one of which was 3 weeks from bankruptcy. Like, they only had like 3 weeks of cash left, and they decided to go for an initial public offering because that's where they were going to get money. And that was like a very controversial thing to do that like no one else would do. They did it. He just talks about a lot of lessons he learned being a CEO. And I'll tell you, I enjoyed the book. A lot of it was a little too dry because some of it was like very specific to like corporate America and not so much to me, but that was okay. I just kind of like, you know, spaced out through some of those parts. But there were 2 parts that really stuck out. Number one, where he talked about people and incompetent people within a company.
Okay.
He's like, people don't seem to understand that there's always going to be incompetent high ups. He's like, because think about it. So you say you have a vice president and he's just clearly not capable of doing the job. Like, he's incompetent. Everyone knows it. They're like, how is he our VP? Like, how did he get here? And he's like, look, at one point, he was successful. Maybe it was just like a little sales guy. And then he was a bigger sales guy. Then he was like a regional sales guy. Then he was like I don't really know all the terms in corporate structure, but like, you know, junior executive. And then eventually, he was competent through all those ranks. I get my hand on camera here. He was competent through all those ranks. And they just, you know, if you keep doing a good job, they keep promoting you. And then finally, he hits his point where he gets another job and all these new responsibilities, and he can't do that one.
I think there's
it's just like the sports world.
Yeah.
How are you going to know that you can't hack it in the major leagues until you get promoted to the major leagues? You know, Trevor Bauer was a good example of that. Trevor Bauer, who's like hitting his stride now in the majors, he just absolutely mowed through the minors, right? Just dominated the minor leagues. Hit the major leagues, was not a good major leaguer for his first, like, 3 or 4 years. Just struggled. And you could say, like that was his point. Like, he just killed it till there, and you wouldn't have known. Like, you can't say, oh, it's, he was good then, he's not good now. That was just, like, where he hit his point of incompetence. And he's since, like, gone through that, and he's doing, you know, much better in the last 3 years. He's becoming I think it looks like he's trending upwards to become a very above average major league pitcher. But that happens for everyone. You can dominate the minors and get to the majors, and you just can't do it. You know, for kids, they can hit fastballs. Then when 14, 15, 16, they can't hit a curveball, and that's it for them. Or you just rise up. You're good at A ball. You get to double A. You can't hack it there. So I thought that was like, it's like an, oh yeah, that makes sense. But it's also, I think people lose that perspective where you see incompetent people and you're frustrated by that. They think they have a position that you wish you had. But again, we all just will eventually get pushed if you're doing well and succeeding. And eventually you'll hit the point where you won't succeed anymore.
Is there, I think there's a name for that. Isn't that called Peter's principle?
Yeah. Okay. It is a principle. I couldn't remember what it was. Yeah,
that's fascinating. Because, I mean, you see it, like you said, you just see it everywhere. And I don't know, there's a, I think it's mildly unavoidable because you never
know
when someone's peak is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then also in that book, the one thing I really didn't like about it, and I don't know the man, but he had a rap quote before every chapter.
Interesting.
And the audiobook narrator, because it wasn't him, like, did the voice in like a gangster kind of voice.
That.
Yes. And I felt embarrassed. I felt embarrassed every chapter.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, this is like this nerdy, nerdy CEO guy, and he's putting in these, like, hardcore, like, they had curse words in it and stuff. I'm like, I'm like, oh, God, this needs to stop.
It was like, blah, 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 Jay-Z.
Like Nas, or like, oh, it was painful.
Why would you do that?
And I wanted to, like, you know, what do you ever review things?
Not really.
I sometimes think, like, I want to review stuff, and I do once in a while with audiobooks, like with narrators. I'll be like, look, this narrator was they're bad or whatever. I try to be. It should have a purpose, not just to be like mean. And on this book, I want to be like, I really like the book, but why did he do that?
Yeah.
Like, he shouldn't have done that.
Please
that
take
was
out.
Very awkward and uncomfortable, and he needs this, like, but there's no point in doing that. That's not really, like, constructive. It's just, like,
was this book, did he narrate it, or was it someone else?
No, someone else narrated it.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah. And that's the other thing. Like, if I was to narrate an audiobook, and then I have, like, do, like, voices and stuff, because they do that a lot, too. When they quote people, a lot of times they quote in, like, another voice. Like, my sister, whenever she's quoting my dad, Annie will go, wow, Dad, y'all, that's just... I'm like, why can't you just say what Dad said instead of, like, making him into a caricature? But I think we all do that to an extent, which is kind of funny.
I think it makes it way funnier.
But in some of these, especially... I think it was the one I read about the New Zealand All Blacks rugby team, and the guy had a very thick, like, New Zealand accent, the narrator. And then when he would do the voices, they just got even thicker. It was kind of crazy, but I don't know.
How much thicker can he go?
It's kind of fascinating. All right, what's your other book?
I will hold off on the one just to spice it up a little bit. The other one I read recently, well, I'm like 80% of the way done, is Boys in the Boat, which is about the University of Washington crew team that won gold at the 1936
I just pictured
U.S. Olympics.
Ants on a log in my head. I don't know why, but as soon as you said Boys in the Boat, I pictured a piece of celery with peanut butter and raisins on it.
It's very analogous.
That's not what it's called. It's called Ants on a Log.
Ants on a Log. Ants on a Log, Boys on a Boat. I liked it a lot. So the narrator is fantastic. And I am a big, big fan of nonfiction material that is expressed in a narrative form. And so, like, it gets, like, I read a lot of history stuff, and a lot of it's pretty dry, which can make it, like, I'm fine with that, but it can make it kind of tough to get through sometimes. But this guy, who I'm spacing on his name, but then another author, like Eric Larson, are guys who, they'll take, like, a... piece of historical nonfiction, so something that actually happened, and then they'll write it in a way that's really, really well structured. And he does a good job of, like, fleshing out the characters, and sometimes he'll go into Barbara Tuckman is another one who does that.
Oh, yeah, Barb.
Yeah.
No, but never, I don't know who that is.
She'll, like, or, like, he'll take, just like a, like, Timmy went to the store. He could write that sentence, or he'll be like, it was a cool autumn morning when Timmy stepped out of, you know, it's like, so he'll, like, make it a little flowery, which I appreciate the craft of writing. So that's sometimes interesting. But anyway, the book is cool because, and I told you this last time on the episode that got deleted, that I really enjoy, or I shouldn't say that. It's interesting to read someone who is passionate about a sport that we care so little about. So, like, you don't care about rowing. I don't care about rowing.
No, boring.
But
not into it.
They, these people, everybody involved in the story loves rowing very much. And so it's interesting to hear someone write about a sport that I think is kind of, like, simplistic, and it's like, okay, whatever, we're going to get in a boat and row. But then sort of, like, the metaphors they draw out of it and the lessons, the same thing that we do with baseball, which I'm sure the people sitting in a rowboat look at baseball.
But there's
like,
way more of things in baseball. Like, come on.
Anyway. Yeah, yeah. But it's fascinating. And so, and then the other character I like in this book is...
any sport you don't have to wear a cup in is just, like, not
a real
sport.
Yeah, it's not even a real sport.
It's not a real sport.
This guy's name is Al Ulbrichtsen. He was the coach of the team. And it's just interesting. I like him as a, I mean, I'm using the word character. He was a real person. But
Big Al.
Just very, like, stoic and even-keeled and unflappable. And he had this very interesting, he was put in this interesting spot where he had basically this group of men who he was just trying to figure out, he was trying to configure, like, who's the best eight-man crew, because you can't just, like, take the eight best rowers, put them in a boat, and they'll be the fastest crew. Like, there's nuances involved in terms of, and that's been the other fascinating thing, is just, like, learning the kind of the responsibilities of, you think that's eight guys in a boat, like, okay, we all row hard and we get to the end, but each rower has, like, a different responsibility. So there's something called a stroke oar, which is the guy who sits in the very first position staring at the what's called the coxswain. And so
okay. He's
like your most technical rower. So he's like your best rower. And you put him in the front because all the other seven rowers or six rowers are staring at him. So basically they're getting their stroke tempo off of him. They're supposed to be getting it from the coxswain who's telling him like 34 or 36.
Row.
Yeah. But they're getting it off him because he's the guy who's actually doing it. And then they have this thing called the engine room, which are like the four or five rowers in the middle who are just like your biggest, strongest. They're just meant to take really, really powerful strokes. And then the guys at the bow of the ship are responsible for keeping the ship true, because, I mean, it will get off kilter, and it's kind of their responsibility to make the small little movements that keep it on track. And so he's trying to figure out, you know, I've got these like young pups who are really just strong and like they never get tired and they are mentally just like, go get them. And then I have these older guys who are more experienced, but maybe less technical rower or like less, they're not as strong. And so it's fascinating because as a coach, you do this every day where it's like when you're filling out a baseball lineup, it's not just like I put my best player, second best, third best, fourth best. There's nuance behind kind of where guys come up in the order and all that kind of stuff. And so it's just interesting to get into his head as a row coach instead of a baseball coach, because there are analogies, and obviously sport is sport. And so there's a lot of talk about just like why these guys, because it was a very difficult road. And then you also have the backdrop of Adolf Hitler's coming to power in Germany. And so there's like talk about, you know, he was basically constructed this crazy, I can't remember the name of it's called, but this crazy big like Olympic stadium. And he was just obsessed with putting together these really great German teams that were going to go and prove his point that, you know, the German race is the ultimate race. And so it's just kind of it was an interesting intersection of historical events that was, and on top of that, he writes really well. So it was a really good book. Well, and it was an audiobook. So, and the guy narrating was fantastic. And I think I've heard listened to an audiobook that he narrated before. And so I got to learn his name because he's really good at it. But yeah, Boys in the Boat.
Ants on a log.
classic
kid food. And by the way, for those of you out there, if you eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, there's only one way to do this, and that's with grape jelly. I just want to throw that out there just as a non sequitur. If you eat a PB&J with anything other than grape, leave a comment and we'll bicker about it. I'll bicker with you. So anyway.
All right. Book club.
Yeah, I think that's all I got.
I want to save some for next time we do book club.
Okay, next time, book club. All right, so we're going to transition into talking about umpires.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so youth baseball, obviously, they're, you know, not great.
Not great.
They vary widely. There can be some very good ones. All of them are human beings. They're people, right? But I don't know what you got on umpires.
Well, so here's my deal with umpires is, when was the last time that you got, I mean, well, if you're not a baseball person, the last time that you went to a baseball game and you went home and you're like, man, that was a really great umpire. Probably never, but the amount of times that you get in your car after a game and you go, oh my gosh, the umpire sucked, is like every single time.
Yeah.
So that has always bothered me because did you ever umpire? I umpired very briefly when I was younger.
Mm-mm.
Okay. It's not easy and it kind of stinks. And umpires are, like you said, human beings and often in short supply. I guess I would say from a technical perspective, probably not very good until you get up into like high school and maybe even like college. Like college, I'm sure, and you can attest to this more than I can, but the jump from high school umpire to college umpire and then college umpire to like pro ball umpire is enormous on each step of the way. So we have to kind of accept that, because also you could easily make the argument that the talent, player talent at each level reflects the umpire, right? So it's like,
yeah,
it's hard to request that an umpire be perfect when your pitcher can't throw strikes. So right. I always right. like keep that sort of in the back of my mind anytime I'm at a baseball game. And I was having this conversation with a dad the other day that I don't even need an umpire to be good, air quotes, in that I don't need him to have like a perfect zone and he's like, you know, really good at establishing his corners of the plate and the top and bottom of his zone. I just need someone who's semi-consistent, because what we tell all of our players, whether we're talking to our pitchers or our hitters or our catchers, is once the zone has been established, you can adjust to it, right? So if you're getting two baseballs off the outside part of the plate consistently, you throw a lot to the outside part of the plate. And so consistency is by far the biggest quality of an umpire that you look for. Now, you don't always get that. And we have, especially like some of the younger, even younger than 13U, those games that I've gone to see at 9U, 10U, 11U, those zones are enormous and often inconsistent. And they fluctuate based on oftentimes the how the game is going. So like if you have a team, we had this at one of our tournaments recently this year, I think it was actually our first tournament, that, you know, we were just like beating up on this team. And so their umpire gave their pitcher an enormous zone and didn't shrink our zone necessarily, but I knew that was coming. Like, that was a thing that the umpire should have done. And I think it gets easy for a parent in the stands to be like, oh my gosh, he just called that pitch a strike and it was at my son's shoelaces. I'm like, yeah, but we're also winning like 14-0. And if he doesn't call that pitch, we're never going to get out of here.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, I guess that was kind of a rambling rant, but I oftentimes have like a special like spot in my brain for umpires where I'm like, I get it. I get what you're trying to do or what you're going through. And until they get really egregiously bad, which honestly I haven't seen, and when I say bad, I mean really inconsistent in that it's a close game and he's giving their pitcher a huge zone and my pitcher a really tight zone, I really haven't seen that too often yet.
Yeah, and for me, like I don't pay that much attention to the umpires. I just assume they're going to be bad, and I don't really mean that in such a negative way. I just, you know, we've talked about it with our players. I'm like, look, just expect the umpires to be bad and expect to get screwed out of some calls, but that's just the way it's going to be. It's just like playing on a bad field. Like, expect to get bad hops. Like, I'm not going to throw a fit about it when, you know, the ball hits a huge rock or very uneven tuft of grass and takes a weird hop. Like, it's just like, it is what it is, right?
Well,
so it's umpiring kind of just, like, it is what it is.
Yeah, and it's, you know, if you use that analogy, you know, their shortstop is dealing with that tuft of grass the same way that you
are.
Yeah,
we're all
so
doing
like,
the same thing. The same thing with mounds. Like, I have no tolerance for pitchers complaining about mounds. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear it all the way up. It doesn't matter. Like, I heard till my last season, like, guys complain about the mounds. And it's like, bro, on the other team is throwing a shutout using that same mound. Like, what's the deal? What do you have to complain about? I don't get it. And, you know, with all those things, both teams are going through the same conditions. You know, even with the luck involved with bloopers and bad calls and good calls, it's all going to even out in the long run. Now, when it's like an important game and you get screwed, so I'll give you an example. We were in a 4-2 game in like the fifth or sixth last weekend, and one of our bottom of the order hitters was up, and it was a 3-0 count. So I'm like, okay, they might walk in a run. We have one out, and we might punch in 3 or 4 runs this inning. 3-0 pitch comes in. It's a strike. Fine. 3-1. 3-1 pitch comes in. It was a clear ball. It was mid-shin at best. I mean, it was a brutal call. Calls it a strike. We get to 3-2, and then he strikes my hitter out on 3-2. Now, that one pitch changed. It changed really the whole game because that was a clear ball. It had been a ball the whole game. It was not like he was calling that pitch consistently. It was like an outlier. It was not close. I mean, when I say mid-shin, like the catcher was catching it with his glove pretty much on the turf. It was a turf field. And that was a walked-in run. It was also a slightly better hitter coming up, and also being only one hitter away from the top of the order coming up, still with bases loaded. Because with one out and the bases loaded, likelihood of a double play is still very slim. So the likelihood we got our leadoff hitter up was pretty high, and we were going to have him up with either a one-run deficit or a tie game at that point, or a lead. And that 1-3-1 pitch legitimately changed the game, and that sucks. Like, it's hard to say, well, over time, it evens out, because it will. But in that one situation, I mean, we pretty much lost the game on that one call. Now, on the other hand, same thing I tell my players, you guys should have got more runs earlier. Like, it's your own fault. Like, you shouldn't have waited to the sixth inning. You should have capitalized on earlier opportunities. You should have had better at-bats. We shouldn't have put ourselves in a position where one pitch and one at-bat could change the game. However, sometimes there's just games where you just don't get that many opportunities either. And when the opportunities that you do get kind of get taken from you, you know, they get taken from you. It is what it is. But at the end of the day, it's hardly worth complaining about. It's just life as a baseball player.
Yeah, and we had a situation go our way in one of our games recently where it was a 3-1 game. And we had runners – we were in the field. They had runners on first and second with no outs. So the beginnings of what was going to be a big inning. And it was really – the wind was really swirly that day. And this kid up hits this really, really high pop fly behind third base. And so our third baseman runs back into the outfield and then is, like, camped underneath it. And – like kind of moving around, and then lunges off to his left and the ball hits the ground. So the kid on second base doesn't know what to do. He's freaking out. And then when the ball drops, he runs to third. We throw to third, and by some miracle, I don't know, our pitcher tags the runner. So that runner's out. What should have been a force play, right? So he should have been on the bag. Well, then I'm like, there's like some commotion, and I'm like, what? And the base umpire goes, I called infield fly, that the batter's out. So now we tag the runner out at third, the hitter's out, so now we have two outs and a guy on second. So completely nuked the inning. And their coach went, not insane, but like was clearly upset because he never heard the infield fly call. I didn't hear the infield fly call either. Should it have been an infield fly? Absolutely not. The umpire's argument was, well, he was camped underneath it, because that's what you're taught as an umpire is if they can make the play on the ball with their back to the outfield and they can camp underneath the ball, that's infield fly. The problem was it was in the outfield grass and the wind was just like
how far in the outfield grass?
He was probably standing 15 feet, 20 feet in the outfield grass. And, I mean, the wind is at play here, so it was not a routine play. But, yeah. Okay, but let's say, I mean, that's his judgment call, so ultimately you have to defer to him. So he calls an infield fly. The other thing was I never heard it. Apparently our pitcher heard it. I never actually asked him, but apparently our pitcher heard it because he had the presence of mind to tag the runner instead of tagging the base. So
good job, lad.
Yeah, no, it was Grant. So I that was a situation. So then, you know, their third base coach was upset. And this brings me to my next question, is I was kind of like putting myself in his shoes, what my reaction would have been, because it would take a lot for me to like get in an umpire's face or yell at an umpire, just because, I mean, in the baseball I've played, it's never made a difference. Like when I can't remember the last time that someone yelled at an umpire and it ended up being good for their team in the long run. And also it's at the end of the day, they're a human being. We're assuming they're trying their best, and maybe they're making mistakes, maybe they're not. And some guys are bad at that job, just like there are bad coaches and there are bad players. But I was just like, his argument probably should have been, why in the world didn't you yell that much louder? If that's going to be the call.
Yeah, that's something that would get me heated for sure. If you don't, well, if you don't make the call early enough to where it screwed my runner, like, yeah, that's a problem.
Well, and the umpire was like, well, you know, I said it. And it's like, well, you didn't say it loud enough. If yeah. if there's question on the field about what that play was, then it wasn't said loud enough.
Yeah, for sure. That's always extremely clear when it's an infield fly at higher levels. I mean, as soon as the ball goes up or shortly thereafter when the ball's on its way up, I mean, they make it very, very well known. And, yeah, I don't know, you know, the 15 feet in the outfield thing, I don't know that I have a huge problem with, because if he is camped, I mean, the ethos of the infield fly is that if you're camped, you can just let it drop right between your legs, pick it up, and get an easy double play. And if that still is kind of what could happen, then, you know, maybe that's the right call. So, but obviously, like, if it gets pretty far into the grass, like, you don't see the infield fly called probably more than, like you said, that 15 feet into the outfield grass. That's yeah. just not realistic. But, yeah, I get that. And I'm in the same way. I'm not going to go argue umpires just because I'm irritated about it. The only time I'm really going to go out is if, to like protect my player. And I had that actually come up this past weekend. I didn't do it. I just kind of hesitated. We had a bang bang play at second base where it looked like he was out. The ball beat the guy by a bunch, but it took a kind of a big turf hop up. The throw was kind of didn't make it there, and it didn't take a long hop. It took like a medium kind of skippy bounce, rubber turfy hop. It's a weird way of describing it, but the tag looked like it was there. The ball beat him by a bunch. Could he have been under it? I mean it was iffy. But my shortstop got a little upset about it, and he, like, said something to the umpire, nothing, like, bad, but he, like, addressed him. And at that point, I should have run out and made my case just to, like, validate him. But I hesitated, and I was kind of, like, thinking, I don't know, and I didn't.
Yeah, I've had a couple
and
situations.
I regret that. I screwed that one up.
Yeah, I've had a couple situations this year where I've gone out just for, like, token conversations where there have been two situations where – that has happened. So there was a play at second and a play at home where the ball beats the guy, but I saw our player miss the tag on both occasions. But it was just like the ball beat them by so much that it's one of those situations where you expect the umpire to bang him just because it was so obvious. But, and so I had to go out there just for that same reason where like our players are like, oh, I tagged him. And I'm like, no, you didn't. But I'll go out there and talk with the umpire for 30 seconds just so it looks like there's some, like you said, that you're on the player's side rather than some like weird neutral party.
Yeah. And it was, and I told this story longer in my own podcast, but we had the same two-man crew for our both of our bracket games, the first game which we won, the second game in the semifinals which we lost. And they just did a really great job. They're fantastic umpires. They're really nice guys. They seem to like be just like good baseball guys. So I, like, chat with them and kind of BS with them between pitches and, like, you know, as we were exchanging lineup cards, when I make a change, like, whatever. And I told the field umpire who made that call at second base, I'm like, hey, man, about that play at second, he was like, you know, like, he was safe. Like, he got under. I'm like, it wasn't that. I'm like, I just should have run out. I should have run out and, like, we should have, like, had it out a little bit just so, because my player got a little upset. And he's like, oh, yeah. He's like, look, if you got to come out here and just, like, you know, pull me aside and be like, hey, you know, you didn't make the wrong call, but I got to give you a little bit of hell and make a, you know, like, you come out here and do it, man. You just come in here. Like, I get it. He's like, it's fine. Like, you know, protect your boys. I'm like it's again, like, that good guy. Yeah. He was a cool dude. And as it turned out, I screwed up again. The end of the game, we were down two runs in the last inning, runner on first, one out. Our guy hits a little humpback liner over first baseman's head. And just being, it was like an exciting back and forth game. Our runner was clearly going to go first to third easily standing up. And as soon as he starts going, I scream and my voice projects really loud, like, get here. And then I look over and our third base coach is holding him. And I was like, and sure enough, he like got halfway to third and then stopped because he saw the hands. Yeah. And I'm like, to my third base coach, I'm like, why did you hold him? And I get that it was like a base-to-base situation because that was the first of two runs that we needed, but at the same time, to me, it was like right off the bat, guaranteed, like a no-brainer. But anyway, like I crossed him up. That was my fault. And anyway, he gets in a little pickle, goes back to second. The throw goes back to second, and he slides in feet first. Ball beats him by a ton. And it was like 9 out of 10 times they call him out. He called him safe. And after the game was over, we lost. We did play. He scored, actually, for us, but we lost by a run. He came over, and he's like, see, I got you. I got you. He's like, I'm like, he's like, he helped me out because, I don't know, we just, like, had a good rapport, you know?
And that's the amount of times. Here's what I tell everybody.
He didn't have to give us that call. Most of the time, he was out, for
and
sure.
The amount of, this is what I tell everybody. I will always try to be best friends with the umpires because the amount of times that I can think of situations like that where I probably got the benefit of a doubt just because the umpire liked who I was versus the amount of times that the umpire was scared I was going to yell at him. Like, you clearly get way more calls being the guy of the two dugouts on the field. You want to be the guy that the umpire – I like that dugout more than I like this dugout because he's going to screw the other dude more than you. So, yeah. I don't know. I just like the whole like getting in an umpire's face and kicking dirt and all that kind of stuff just doesn't really have a place in youth baseball.
That was one of the things he told me. He's like, yeah, if you need to come in here and kick some dirt on me, just do it. He's like, I won't toss you. Don't worry.
Yeah. But, so. Yeah, it's tough. Sometimes we had a couple of plays where, again, I've seen the umpire make the right call, but our parents have seen something else. And that's the other thing where it's like, just making sure that parents aren't like, if something needs to be said, the umpire, it needs to be coming from coaches. Cause that's the other thing that'll piss an umpire off super fast is when they're getting it from every angle.
Yeah. And of course, on the flip side of that, like one of our first games, we had a triple header. It was not like a sanctioned tournament, it was just a round robin. And we had the same 2-man crew for all three games. And at the very first, before the very first pitch, we met, went over ground rules, and he was like, yeah, so, you know, you've got 1 minute between, you know, you get 8 pitches and then you get 5 and you get 1 minute between. And if they're late, if they're not out there quick enough, you know, I'm going to cut them off. I'm like, wait. So if my pitcher's slow out there, he's only get 3 warm-up pitches. I'm like, dude, that's not okay. Like my pitcher needs his warm-ups. And he's like, then just get him out. I'm like, I am going to get him out there, but just,
yeah, don't.
Like, what are you doing right now? Like, this isn't the freaking World Series. Why do we need to be like exact on 1 minute? This isn't one of those massive tournaments where it isn't really important to be on time. Like, dude, my pitcher's arms matter way more than 15 seconds of your time.
Right.
So that's just the kind of thing. Like a lot of the umpires, like, again, I'll just kind of like chat with them a little bit between innings here and there. And most of them are just like relaxed. It's youth baseball. Who cares? We're here to like all do a decent job. It's not that big a deal. And this guy's making a big deal about, you know, being like the pitch count Nazi. It's like, come on, dude. Like, it's not okay for my pitcher to get 3 pitches to warm up. 5 is even a little bit short. Like, that's normal. I get it. But it's like, come on, man.
And that is a thing that you'll hear, which I do agree with, is that's one of the signs of a bad umpire as a guy who is trying to affect the game. Like, this is going to be my game. And I'm going to if your pitcher's late, he's not going to get all this. Like, relax. We don't need to be that crazy with stuff. And when you have umpires who want to be a part of the game that bad, then it's like, come on, relax.
And if he just rephrased it, you know, be like, hey, I really want to keep the game on track. So please just help your guys. I'm not going to cut their warm up short, but please just keep them in the 1 minute. Like, of course. Like, it's just the way he phrased it, you know?
Right.
And he was just like, after I kind of gave him, I'm like, look, dude. And I talked to the other umpire or the other manager. I'm like, and he was like on the same page. He's like, yeah, like that's not okay. My kids need at least their 5 warm-up pitches. You know, then he was just like, well, just make sure they hustle out there. I'm like, of course. Like, I'm not going to not have them hustle out. Like, that's not the issue. Just if whatever happens, my catcher just happens to forget, like my backup catcher, or just someone's not ready or whatever, don't just be, you know, a hard ass about it. Just relax. Yeah. Like, it's not the end of the world. We'll hustle out. Don't assume that we're not going to. I don't know. It just, again, it just depends on the way you deal with people. And he was kind of, he ended up being a decent guy. And after the first game, we kind of chatted because the other team was a bunch of super complaining parents and coaches. They're on his case constantly about all the stupidest little things. And our parents are great. And they were just supportive of our players, didn't have a peep. So he became like our friend in our corner too. So, you know, it's just like you said. I don't know. Maybe he's got to be a little more brusque with people at first.
Yeah.
Just to kind of like lay down
the
law.
Tone.
And then, you know, but he's a decent guy. So, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much all I think I got on umpires. What else you got on umpires?
I mean, you just hope they don't change. Like, you just don't change the game. That's
right,
pretty much it.
Right.
But like you said, when you think about your response to them, it's like, this call's not going to get changed.
Well, that's
anyone else on the team upset about it, or is it just I'm upset about it? the call's not going to get changed. So just kind of like it is what it is a lot of times. And it's one thing if it's become like a pattern, like that was a strike consistently, and now it's like ball. Like, what are you doing? Like, why is this changing? Like, my pitcher's making good pitches and you're making it tough. When they become patterns, then you have to decide, like, I need to say something or do something because this pattern is starting to hurt our chances of winning. Whereas just like the random bad strike calls, bad, you know, like those are just, that's just like whatever.
Well, and even then, like when it comes time for that, where you're like, okay, something needs to be said, very rarely is the move to yell from the dugout, where it's almost always call time and go talk to a guy. Because one thing that umpires don't want is they don't want you to show them up in front of a field full of people. So they don't want you to be like, hey, idiot, you're being stupid and you're doing a bad job.
Stupid, dumb guy.
Whereas if you call time and you go out and talk to them, you could be talking about anything. You could be talking about some substitution you're going to make two innings from now, but you can be like, hey, man, like that pitch has been there for three innings and now it's not there anymore. Like, what's the deal? And so you can have like a civilized conversation, and most guys will appreciate the fact that, hey, that guy came out and like talked to me and was looking me in the face rather than sheltered in his dugout, like yelling things at me. So there's always a better way to get your point across, even when they start to suck and you need to call it to their attention.
Yeah. And I think the last thing I'll put out there is that I don't know who started the blue thing.
Oh, I don't
and
like that.
As a kid, I always heard blue. I thought it was okay. And then I can't remember when. And I think it was, I don't think it was college. I think it was one of my first years in pro ball. I called, like I had a ball or something, and I had to get the umpire's attention, which is rare anyway. And I called him blue. And someone on my team, I think it was a coach, so they was like, hey, they don't like that. Call him sir. If you don't know his name, call him sir. Mm-hmm. And I never forgot that. So every game I really try really hard to remember their names. And if I forget it, I ask again before I go back to the dugout. So I can yell out, hey, Alex, like,
right,
you know, where was that? Or Alex, can I get a, just to use their name. Or
Dwayne, can I get least, time? Or Dwayne.
Very least use sir. But blue's commonplace, and it's not like it's derogatory, but it's just like anything else. It's just like know their names and call them sir, like be respectful. So I tell my kids it's all sir, it's not blue.
If you're a player,
it's their name, and I tell my assistant coach their name. So
yeah, I tell my players sir. I'm not even a huge fan of players saying their name either. Like players say sir.
Yeah.
Blue coming from a 13-year-old is a little like, ugh, don't do that.
Yeah. So all right, umpires.
Umpires.
All right, our last topic for today, catching.
Catching. Catching at the youth level.
Yeah.
So here's the first thing I'll say. It becomes, I don't, outside of the pitcher, I think the catcher, especially at 13, 14, is such an integral position on the field. Like, if you have a really, really good catcher, everybody's life gets so much easier. Versus if you are lacking on that in that position, especially at younger ages, but really, I mean, forever in baseball. But I don't know, it just seems especially apparent to me at 13, 14, that a really good defensive catcher can make a huge difference. And one of the biggest contributions, one of the biggest contributions is it just like helps pitchers so much. Like when you have a guy who not only can catch the ball well and can frame well, but can block well, where your 13, 14 new pitchers aren't scared with, you know, a guy on third and two outs to bounce their 0-2 changeup. Like they're not worried about that. And if you can take that kind of fear out of their brain, I think it just gets so much easier for guys on the bump.
Yeah, and I coach 14U, which I think is a big jump in what you'd expect from kids. That's like kind of where they're transitioning out of youth baseball, because a lot of those kids are pretty grown. Like my team is, our 14U team is probably a little bit bigger than our 15U team. So that 14-15 age group, what's expected of them is very different. So for me, like we have three catchers, and I was very clear from the beginning that when a ball hits the dirt, we're going to have a full block, or you're not going to catch, or you're not going to go out there and catch. And when you watch a lot of teams, there's a lot of players who block extremely well. We've been taught very well. And then there's lots of kids who don't know how to block, and they'll kind of go down, or they'll go down to the, kind of like a half lunge, or they'll go down, their glove is up, and all that stuff at this level is just not acceptable anymore. Because you can't block, like a lot of balls go to the dirt, obviously. And as kids start to throw breaking balls, more and more balls go to the dirt. So it really just becomes imperative, and it becomes like a fork in the road where you can either block or you can't, and it's not necessarily because you don't know how, it's because it hasn't just been like force fed that you absolutely have to block every ball that hits the dirt. Now, there's some times when even big league catchers pick the ball, doesn't make it right. And fastballs, admittedly, and you can speak more to this, are tougher mm-hmm. to block, especially when kids throw hard, because that's the biggest thing. Like, my team has some hard throwing 14-year-olds that are into the mid 70s, a couple in the upper 70s, and if they throw a fastball that's like barely going to hit the dirt, like maybe hit the dirt, maybe not, that's just a really tough ball. And even the big leagues, that's the one you see go to the screen on a fastball more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Big league catchers can leap up and catch a high fastball. They're super athletic. But when you see that fastball that is just going to hit the dirt right where the mitt goes, where it's going to hit like the bottom, like here's the ground, it's just going to boom right where their catcher's mitt goes. That's the one where you just barely slip under because it's not clear if they can catch it or if they have to block it. And but anyway, just that the decision making for me is it's clearly where speeds get higher, it's tough for catchers to mentally, as soon as it leaves the hand, their brain clicks, oh, trajectory of this changeup means it's going to hit the dirt. I got to block. It's going to be over here. I got to slide. It takes a lot of practice and a lot of repetition. And it really just does, I think, take someone to enforce, like, no, it's not okay for you to not have your mitt on the ground in a full block on every single one that hits the dirt. Because if you allow some of it, then it just continues to be sloppy over time, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of it's analogous to hitters hitting, learning how to hit off speed pitches, where you're looking for the same thing, that, you know, a fastball versus a curveball versus a changeup looks different out of the hand to a hitter. But your ability to recognize that takes time and it takes a lot of volume. You have to see a lot of those pitches to start to establish, like, what does a curveball look like out of a 14, 15-year-old's hand? Same thing goes with catching, that, you know, there is that trajectory that you see a ball leaving the hand where you're like, that ball is a problem. And part of it is just seeing more pitches, and you have to see a lot of pitches and block a lot of pitches to get good at it, which is just like a simple answer. But what I always tell my catchers is there's a big, big mental component to it, where if you're mentally prepared to block, which I'll kind of talk about in a second, blocking gets easier, right? So by being mentally prepared to block, I mean, when you're teaching a catcher, they go, they're in first position, they're giving their sign, and then they hop up into second position. So when you're in second position, your feet are going to be a little bit wider, so you have a wider base, the weight is on the ball of your foot, your butt goes up in the air a little bit, and what this is meant to do is make it easier for you to either get down to block, or should someone be stealing a base, you can get into throwing position easier. And so the whole idea then, how we transition to block is, we're going to take our cleats essentially and kick them out from behind us, whoop, so that our knees drop straight down and we're in a position to block. So that's why our butt kind of has to get up. Because if you're sitting with your butt on your heels, you have to then transition to get up and then clear space for your feet to get out from underneath you. So it just takes too long, right? So you go, okay, great, I understand that. Now I have, maybe I'm a technically sound blocker in my dry drills or whatever, and then I'm trying to get that to then happen at game speed. Well, that requires that you can identify a pitch to then get down to block. What makes that way easier is when you can kind of play an odds game in your head, where you say to yourself, what are the chances this next pitch is going to be thrown in the dirt? For an 0-2 curveball, that's obviously really easy to do, because you're like, there's a really high chance this is going to require that I block. And so if you look at, I mean, if you have a decent catcher, they're going to block a really high percentage of that 0-2 curveball that bounces, right? It's the...
So they're kind of ready to block and adjust to catch.
Exactly.
Rather than,
exactly,
it seems like everyone else is ready to catch and they have to like think to block.
Okay. So that's the point I want to make, where if you look at, it's the 1-0 fastball that's in the dirt. That's the one that gets by guys, right? And so, because you expect, oh, well, what are the chances this guy throws his 1-0 fastball in the dirt? Like, it shouldn't be mm-hmm. any, but of course it's going to happen. And so what I tell everybody is be in a mental state where you are mentally prepared to block, because one of two things is going to happen. Either there's going to be an actual pitch you have to block, but you're already mentally prepared to do it, so then you have no reservation about getting down to block, or it's going to be a pitch in the air, but you're already in a position to catch it. So you don't have to do anything. So even if it surprises you, air quotes, where you're like, oh, he's actually throwing this 1-0 fastball at my mitt, I don't have to do anything to adjust to it. Now, the other caveat I'll throw in here is anytime I'm talking to my catchers about that, that's a really effective strategy, but it's also mentally exhausting. Where if you imagine you have to catch 130 pitches in a game, to be doing that every single time on top of keeping track of what the count is, what pitch I should throw, who's on base, what's the score, what's the inning, all that kind of stuff, it's mentally exhausting to do that. But unfortunately, that's just kind of the gig as a catcher, is you have to – it's physically tiring. You're, like, leaning on your quads and your hamstrings a lot and your hips. But you also, it's also mentally fatiguing in that you're trying to play the little cat and mouse game of getting hitters out on top of being mentally prepared to, like, wear a ball off the chest if you need to. But it's just, like, the only way to do it. And especially when you're learning, like, if you just, like, put in that philosophy and you did it pitch after pitch after pitch after pitch, you're going to get to a point where you've seen enough pitches that it starts to become second nature. Like, MLB catchers probably aren't going through that thought process on when they're receiving a pitch, because yeah, they've seen enough that they're just, like, instinctually going to go boop. But when you're 13 and you haven't seen any of those pitches, that's the kind of mental approach you have to take.
Yeah, and I actually have a perspective of this just catching bullpens. Like, I've caught a lot of bullpens, and usually without gear. When I catch, like, harder throws, I'll put shin guards on. But I just catch a lot of, especially for, like, the youth pitchers, like 14 and below, rather than have a catcher come in, like, they're throwing 70. It's not that 70 or less, not that big a deal. I'll just catch them. Plus, it just gives me a – because I like seeing the catcher perspective anyway. But I did this just yesterday. So I had a lesson yesterday with a kid that we've worked with for a long time, Jace, and he rarely bounces his fastball. But when he throws a changeup, it has a good amount of sink to it, and he'll bounce it some of the time. So when I'm catching his fastball, I'll just, like, sit back on my legs and just be prepared to catch it. But when he throws changeups, I usually kind of go into second position because I don't want to get hit in the nuts. So I kind of got to get ready to get out of the way. So for me, it's like that same thing. Like, I have a pretty good idea based on the pitcher. If I can be comfortable, you know, with him throwing his fastball, I'm very comfortable that, you know, 28 out of 30 are going to be in my mitt or above, which, not that you want to be up in the zone, but he doesn't really bounce fastballs that often. Or if he does, they just, like, they're pickable. Mm-hmm. They're not, like, bouncing. You know, the one that's going to hit me in the body is going to be, like, the short, the in-between hop where it bounces 4 feet in front of the plate. Those are tough to pick. And obviously doesn't throw a breaking ball. But, like, when I throw high school, when I had to catch high school kids throwing, and high school kids are the worst because they throw hard enough to hurt you. Their breaking pitches are inconsistent, so they're in the dirt a lot. The spins is inconsistent, so they bounce different. Like, a curveball with, you know, 1-7 spin will bounce backwards, but high school kids throw the worst curveballs in the world, so they bounce all different directions. They'll bounce 4 curveballs in a row, and then they'll bounce 4 changeups in a row, then they'll throw a fastball, like, nowhere in particular. It's those guys that have enough speed and enough stuff, but not that much command, it makes it pretty scary. I know you've expressed that sentiment. Catching, like, pro guys is way easier than catching a high school kid. Even though you could be throwing 95, you have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen, and just right to your mitt or right to the little quadrant that you're at. But with kids that are still learning to throw strikes and that maybe throw pretty hard, it just can be fastball, slider, changeup. It's just all over, and you're just nervous as a catcher trying to figure out what to do. So obviously being a good strike thrower helps a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, no, I get that. It's definitely wears you out, and like I'm in the mindset to get out of the way, which that's for me blocking. I'm gonna block it, but I'm gonna get out of the way. Or I'm gonna, you know, protect myself, or I'm in the mindset to just, like, receive it. I have a pretty good idea that I'm safe, and so I understand that. But yeah, no, it's tough. You just see that they haven't seen enough pitches, and when they get harder throwers, and there's just a lot to the pitching and catching positions. There's a lot going on for them to have enough mental bandwidth to process everything. Like, all right, the runner might be going. If it's down, I have to block it. If you know, first and third,
they might be situations, bunting.
Like, yeah, there's lots of stuff that goes on. And often, if they forget, then the ball goes down, then it's too late, and then they try to catch it, or they kind of, like, half get down, they try to catch it. And even if they block it, like, we had a lot of successful blocks this past weekend where they successfully blocked it, but their your sixth hole was not covered, like, not good enough. Like, I know you got an okay result, but that's got to get better because those are going to get by you over time.
It never gets easier too, because, like, okay, so let's say, I mean, because at 13, basically what I'm working on with catchers is and I hesitate to use the word scared of the ball, because they're not, but no one wants to get hit with a baseball.
It's not second nature to throw yourself in front of them.
Exactly. So that's kind of what you're working on 12-13, is getting guys used to impact. And, you know, I like to think that I was like this. I know some of the best catchers that I played with were just, like, unapologetically not scared of getting hit, where you look at really good catchers and they'll just like throw arms and shoulders and wrists in front of balls to, just to knock them down. And you kind of have to teach yourself that. It's not like, it's like you said, it's not, no one has that nature, animal nature. So
yeah,
you're just like teaching impact and like how the technique behind how to minimize the pain of impact, really. And so you kind of work on that. So then at 14 ish, now you're working on like more technique stuff. Like you're talking about like, okay, it's not good enough just to be in a position to block. We have to be in a good technical position that we're like, the ball is ending up kind of where we want it to go. Because then at maybe even good 14 or 15, you might have a great technical block. But then if you're not, if the ball's not doing what you want it to do, or you're not positioned to get up, guys will run on you anyway. And it defeats the whole purpose that, you know, if a ball squirts away from me because I'm too big in my chest, good runners are going to be reading that down angle. And as soon as they see it squirt away, they're off to the next base. And then it's just like you had a pass ball. So you're like working on that. I mean, there's always a jump in kind of the results you're trying to gain as a catcher as you move up through. So it never really gets easier, but it's just kind of like, I mean, pitching never gets any easier either. So it's just kind of, it's a tough position and it takes a certain mindset. And there's a lot, what's fascinating to me is I feel like there's a lot of kids who like catching, but there aren't a lot of kids who I would say are cut out to be catchers in that catching is fun because you are involved in every play. You have a high effect on the game. I don't know. It's just like a cool position. You get to wear cool stuff, but it's also, I mean, it takes a weird person to be a catcher too.
Well, and like catching bullpens and just watching, I feel like catching is, and I don't mean to say that it's easy because it's certainly not, as we've already discussed. I feel like catching is one of the most controllable positions where if you wanted to be great at catching, you could do it. I feel like if I went back, knowing what I know now, like obviously like I love pitching and I wouldn't, if I went back in time, I would not be a pitcher. But I feel like if I went back in time, knowing what I know now, I could start as like an eighth grader and I could have, I think, maybe been like a big league catcher. I mean, you see guys convert in the minor leagues, and if you just, say you spent 2 hours a day receiving balls from a pitching machine 100 miles per hour at the bottom of the zone, working on your receiving, all the stat casts, like we know what a good catcher is and what a bad catcher is and what framing is. If you just spent so much time with your blocking technique, caught every bullpen you could possibly want to catch, constantly work on your throwdowns, it's like catching, there's less high speed, really difficult movements. I'm not saying it's easy because it's not, but if I went back in time 1,000 times, I would never had a good enough swing or never been fast enough or never had the hands to like play professional baseball as a shortstop or as a center fielder or any of that. Like I just physically couldn't do it. And I might never have been able to like pitch in the big leagues if I could go back and like do things differently. But as a catcher, I feel like if you put in the time and you're extremely focused and have just a incredible dedication to your craft, you can make it happen. I feel like it's very controllable in that sense because the skills that you have to learn, while they're difficult, they're very easy to repeat in your home. They don't require tons of equipment. They just require a lot of resolve, and you got to catch a lot of bullpens, and you got to be, like you said, be willing to wear balls off your body. But I mean, a catcher can be as good as he wants to be, as far as I can tell. I don't know if you'd agree or disagree with
that. Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of hit it on the head that it's, the skills, while not easy, it might be the easiest position on the field to log time doing.
Yeah. So nothing like stopping you from blocking 100 balls your dad rolls to you in your living room.
Right. Whereas if I'm a center fielder, how often do I have the opportunity to see a baseball off a bat? Like it's like, it's hard. How often is a shortstop even? Like I can get ground balls in the summertime, but it's like, it's a tougher thing to get done.
And you can track, like I could track fly balls. I was a center fielder and I thought I was decent tracking fly balls. I just would never have been fast enough. You know, like if you're not a 6'5 runner, you can't play big league center field. Doesn't matter how good you can track a fly ball, you cannot play at that level. I mean, pretty much. So,
I think there are a couple mental like barriers to jump over. But once you're over those, then it's like, just how many practice hours can you log, really?
Yeah. And, you know, if you'd have, you know, your throwing mechanics are also pretty controllable. It's a very simple throwing motion. Now, there are definitely points where if you don't have a good arm at 15, 16, your mechanics are a little tougher to change. I'm not saying they can't change, but obviously a throwing arm is important. The better a thrower you are, that obviously pays dividends. You know, I think the big league sliding scale is most throwdown speeds are between like 80 and 89. Mm-hmm. There's a couple 90s once in a while, which is pretty hard considering how fast they move kind of, they don't get as much of their body into a throw like an outfielder, obviously, or like a normal crow hop. But 80 to 89 or 90 is the sliding scale, with the average being like 84 to 86, I think, is that that's, I think, the StatCast data on how fast a throwdown is to second base. And, you know, so I don't know. It's a very underrated, it's a very underrated position for sure.
And the only other thing I'll throw in there is, you know, we talk about that, and obviously the component we haven't talked about is you have to be able to hit as well. But the one thing I will say is at youth levels, and really even in still into high school and into pro ball, college and pro ball, you can get away with 100 points less batting average if you're just a really, really good catcher. And, like, really good catchers will earn their way into lineups and be forgiven their ability to not hit as well, just because – and they've, that's been another, like, big StatCast thing, is they found out years ago that a good defensive catcher will save way more runs than he could ever possibly produce in the plate at the plate. So it's like, the, you know, they talked about the whole comeback of, like, the catcher who hits 220, because they know that I don't need him to hit 35 bombs and have 80 RBIs. I need him to save me how X amount of runs behind the plate just because he's so good.
Yeah, and that, in the book Big Data Baseball by Travis Salchuk, he chronicles the Pirates and how they turned around their organization in a couple seasons under Clint Hurdle, and Russell Martin, the catcher, was integral to that. And they talked about how, I think the guy's last name was Fox, but like Mr. Fox was one of their analysts who was the first to develop like framing statistics. And so he was like calculating how much good framing versus average framing versus bad framing would save in runs. And when he first like came up with his formula and like ran the number was so high, like it saved so many runs and like wins per season, that he thought like the numbers had to be wrong. But it turned out that they weren't. Like, it was just extremely underrated. And he's like, oh my God, no one else knows this. No one else is doing this. We have a huge advantage. And after that got out, now everyone knows it. So, you know, the playing field has leveled once again. But, I mean, saving a huge amount of runs, because with all the advanced sabermetrics, you know, we know it's just about added value and runs and added, you know, wins to your team. And the difference between hitting 220 and 260, which, you know, seems pretty high,
substantial,
is maybe way smaller than the difference between being an average framing catcher and an exceptional framing catcher. So it's not about, like, we'll just say, hey, all right, we lose 2 runs on this catcher because he hits 220 versus another guy we get for 260, but he saves us 7 runs because he's such a better framer than him. So obviously it's just simple math. Would you rather have 7, you know, runs added or runs saved than 2 runs? And that's just an example. I don't think that's really the way the stats work, but it's like pretty cut and dry. They're trying to discern value from players in different positions. And I mean, you see at the youth level, and it's one of those things where, you know, say your company, like American Airlines, like airlines have taken a lot of flack. They shuttle through millions of happy, like whatever, neutral customers. They fly on their plane. Everything goes smoothly. Not a big deal. But you drag one person off the plane and everyone knows about it, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like catching. Like, you catch a lot of balls, but the couple that go to the backstop that cost your team a run, it's like, that's what people remember. And that's a big deal. And to be a great catcher, there has to be an extremely high level of detail and very few. Like, you can't, it's not like, oh, but I blocked 27 out of 30. Well, it's like, well, dude, the 3 that you didn't block costs us a game.
Right.
So, like, I don't know what you want me to tell you. Like, oh, you get a 90%. That's an A in school, but that's an F because we lost because you couldn't block that darn ball. So, you have to be exceptionally good. I mean, I think people forget when they watch Major League Baseball just how good they are. And it's not even Major League Baseball, collegiate baseball. There's not many balls going to the screen. Whereas I watch games and there's 20 balls go to the backstop, and it like hurts me inside watching it. I'm like, oh my God, another ball, another ball, another ball.
Mm-hmm.
The catcher's constantly running back and the runners are constantly moving up, and it like hurts my soul. But that doesn't happen at higher levels of baseball. Oh, and the one thing I was going to mention, I wonder if you're a coach and you're watching this, feel free to like chime in and let us know, but I've seen more turf hops that are unblockable than like ever. And maybe I never noticed it before, but I feel like it's awful. Like, my catcher's wearing, like, getting down to block a ball properly, and then the ball hits him in the mask and just goes somewhere.
Yeah.
And it happens all the time because the ball, when it hits the turf, you know, it's got backspin or forward spin, whatever, depending on the pitch, but it just kind of grips that rubber, compresses the rubber infield in that turf, and then it bounces. Just like that play we were talking about in our other video. You know, those, some of those long hops on turf, they don't skid. They just, like, catch and they bounce. And I wonder if that's a thing, because, like, almost, like, so many college fields are turf now. Like, it's obviously, it's got to be the majority are turf rather than dirt.
Yeah.
And grass. And, like, you never see that happen in the majors where it takes, like, a big hop. It always skids because it hits dirt or it hits the plate, and it just sort of, you know, bounces light. But I don't know. Is turf changing the way catchers have to – there's nothing they can do about it.
There's nothing you can do. And I would say that it's definitely worse, obviously, at youth levels, because you'll get balls that, like, bounce in front of the plate, and then it's just, like, forget about it. But where I noticed it most in my brief playing days, but even still – because I mean, one of your favorite things to do is when you have a lesson to throw curveballs back to them that bounce, mm-hmm. and then it scoots on them, and then they freak out. Well, when you get older and you're in high school and college and you're playing on turf fields and you have that guy that throws that curveball, that effect is amplified, and then you wear a lot of balls off your shoulders and off your face, blocking those curveballs on turf, just because they are some guys are throwing that curveball to bounce in the corner of the plate. So then then you're just toast. There's not like you said, there's not a lot you can do.
And maybe at higher velocities, maybe, you know, like in college, because that's what I'm wondering. I'm like, is this something that happens at all these colleges? Like, their catchers are suddenly, like, missing a couple balls a game because they're taking – but maybe at the higher velocities and, like you said, less fastballs hitting the front of the plate, maybe they do skid more just because more speed in a linear
– that might make sense because
– I don't know.
What I remember about blocking on turf is the – especially, like, fastballs – they hit me in the same spot, but they hurt more, which would be potentially what you're talking about there, where it's like they're skipping the same way, but they're not losing as much energy. So you're just like, you're wearing a little harder on turf than you would.
Well, I would think they'd still lose. I don't know. I'm kind of like on the fence about turf if it takes energy or gives energy. Because like balls that don't have a high hop, so like you hit that one that almost immediately rolls, they die on turf. And if you have a thin grass, they don't die, I don't think, quite as fast. But it also depends. Maybe
It depends on the turf and
the infield. Because I know it's – what field was I at? It was a long time ago. But they were talking about how they had more sand in the infield and around the catchers, around the dish, than they did elsewhere. Because the more sand you have in the infield, the less bouncy it is.
Right.
So then it starts to play more normal. Because you get to some of those turf fields and they're all rubber. And that was, I think, the standard for so long they didn't even think about it. But, you know, this past weekend we were playing on turf, and I hit them fly balls, and I made all my outfielders let the first two bounce just so they could predict what it was going to do, because you can't go out there the first time in a game and expect it to bounce off the grass and take a normal hop. It's going to legitimately bounce over your head if you run hard, check up, and then it hits a couple feet in front of you. It's not going to just bounce, you know, to your crotch. It's going to bounce over your head and be a triple or a home run. So we did that stuff, but when you see rubber, it could be like a huge, like 9-foot bounce. But when you have a significant amount of sand in that turf, it just really deadens it. And I wonder if there's an effect there. Maybe all colleges have sand in their infield. That it plays a lot more naturally, so maybe they do now. I don't know. It's been a long time since I was in college, but
An there eternity.
Yeah, it's been an eternity.
And then if you
10 years now,
if you're not convinced to be a catcher, you can just watch that video of Yadier Molina wearing that ball off his nuts.
I didn't see that, but I heard about it.
Oh my gosh, it did not look pleasant. 104 miles an hour off the cup. No, thank you.
Wait, who threw it?
It was a foul tip.
Oh.
Or I don't know what it was. I think it was 104.
That's not ideal. Well.
Yeah.
That's it. Catching. All right, well, what a great episode.
That was great.
Episode 44.
44 in the books.
So if you don't already, subscribe to our fantastic new YouTube channel.
Review us, like us, love us.
Do all those things. We need that. Also, social media, Warbird_Academy on Snapchat, Warbird Senators on Snapchat, Coach Dan Blewett on Snapchat, Warbird Academy on Instagram, Warbird Senators on Instagram, Coach Dan Blewett on Instagram. There's so much of all this. Same thing goes for Facebook.
Yeah.
So if you don't interact with us, you're going to start to see a lot more content from us on social media. So we want your questions. We want to interact with you. So don't deprive us
of
that.
Let's be friends.
Don't deprive us of that. All right.
Let's hang out.
Hit that subscribe button, bro.
Yeah, bro.
All right. See you next week.